Okay, so welcome to all of our friends online. Also, because I've just actually been reading the Sanjuta Nikaya one about the anger-eating demon. So I should also say welcome to all of our enemies who've joined us. So a special welcome to all of those as well. So yeah, if you come here wishing us ill and harm, then welcome. Very good. So that's okay. That's fine. Once. All right, everybody. So welcome back. And we are hoping that, just give it a minute. We're hoping that we're going to have a less noisy class than last week when we had to actually cancel because the class was so ridiculous. The noise was so ridiculous. Well, the class was ridiculous as well, but the noise was also. So there is an event being held here today, but it seems to be quite quiet. So hopefully it won't be an issue for us. So anyway, I'm Bhante Sujato, and I am. Hang on, last week was. The week before. All right, sorry. Thank you. Oh, thanks to Venerable Prasanna for leading the class last week. Yeah, so that was awesome. Yeah, I really appreciate it. Today, Venerable Metta Vihari is joining us from Perth. So he's over to do the ABCAP course on Buddhism and Psychotherapy. So he's in Sydney for a couple of days. And we will maybe, if everyone feels good about it, maybe we could do some chanting. Is that good? Excellent. Maybe some meditation? Yes, Ishika, you want to do some meditation? Okay, excellent. And maybe have some Dhamma talk. In fact, for the Dhamma talk, I still actually have a talk that I was supposed to give on the day that was cancelled that I haven't given yet. So I'll do that one. Let us begin with the chanting. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Itipiso bhagavaraham samma sambuddho vijja charana sampanno sugato kavito anuttaro purisa dhamma saharati sadha deva manusanam buddho bhagavati. Svakato bhagavata dhammo sandirthiko akaliko
Ehi pasiko o panaiko pachatam veditabo vinyuhiti. Supatipanno bhagavato savakasangho. Ujjupatipanno bhagavato savakasangho. Nyaya patipanno bhagavato savakasangho. Samichi patipanno bhagavato savakasangho. Yadidam chattari purisayugani atha purisapungala. Esa bhagavato savakasangho. Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakhirneyo anjali karaniyo anuttaram punyaketam lokasati.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, we can probably shut the door now. Okay, so time has come to do some meditation together. And I want to remind us of what we're doing when we're meditating and why it works or doesn't work. Like, one of the things that I find funny about meditation is that nobody says, you know, how's your meditation going? Oh, it's going great. I'm a really good meditator. Like, nobody does that. If they do, it's a serious red flag, right? If someone says, oh, yeah, I'm a great meditator, then you're like, yeah, are you though? So we have this kind of perception about it. Right? But personally, I think everyone who meditates is a good meditator. I think all of the things when people describe what they're doing, all of the problems that they're having in meditation, and they say, oh, I'm having this problem and that problem and the other problem. Then to me, a few problems they're having. Hey, welcome. Are you with anyone else? No, we're not expecting anyone else today. No. So, where was I? Oh, yeah, problems. That's right. Yeah. So people say, oh, I've got this problem. So I'm thinking a lot. Oh, I've got this problem. Oh, I've got this pain in my body. Oh, I've got this problem. My mind keeps being distracted. And what I hear you saying is, I became aware of the fact that I was thinking a lot. I became aware of the pains in my body. I became aware of the fact that I'm distracted all the time. And so it's this reflective capacity that you develop in meditation, which is the root of wisdom. So a lot of words for how the Buddha talks about meditation have the prefix, a Pali prefix, pati, which means like re or against. So you have like pachawekana, is like reviewing, or pati sankhara, right, so reflection, so on. So it has all this kind of idea that you're kind of looking in a mirror and you're reflecting about what is happening. So don't be down on yourself just because, you know, your mind's distracted. Don't think that that's a problem with your meditation. That's just how the meditation goes. If it were easy to abandon all movement in the mind, to become super quiet and to realize the truth in meditation, then we would have all become arahants long ago and samsara would be empty. Okay, but we can infer, I think, from the fact that samsara is notably not empty. Maybe that explains that why there's no aliens, though. I'm just thinking about that, right? Maybe they all did their meditation properly and they all got enlightened, and that's why all the aliens have gone and there's only us. We're the only people in the entire universe so stupid that we, even though the Buddha told us to do something so very simple, and we still can't get it. I'm not saying that that is the case, just in case you're wondering. I'm just musing aloud here for a moment. Anyway, I'll cease musing. So, wisdom, you see, here's the thing. Wisdom is a natural capacity of your mind. It's not something that some people have and some people don't have. It's just how the mind works. And I think one of the problems we have in the modern day is we think we can sort of quantify and restrict the idea of wisdom or intelligence, and some people have it and some people don't. And as soon as you go down that road, it seems to me that bad things always happen. And certainly not the Buddhist point of view. The Buddhist point of view is that your mind is developed. Your mind grows according to how you behave and how you act. Sure, some people maybe have more natural aptitude in certain directions than others, but it doesn't mean that there's a sort of overall function that some people have and then some people don't. So if we feel like we're struggling in meditation, if we feel like we're alone, if we feel like we're lost, just remember there are literally millions of meditators all over the world also feeling lost and alone, and also feeling like they're struggling. It's not you, and it's not personal. It's just how the mind is. So the good news is, because the natural function of the mind is to be aware. I'm going to repeat that again. The natural function of the mind is to be aware. So if we just let the mind do its thing, it knows stuff. That's kind of what minds do. So that apparatus, that potential for knowing, is already built in. Welcome. Welcome. Oh, hi, how are you going? Hey, everyone. Come sit down the front. Come on. You're not allowed to hide at the back. Come on. All right. Very good. What did I say about hiding at the back? No, it's all right. See where you like. I'm just messing around. Okay, so we've just for those who come late, we've just done a little bit of chanting, and I'm just saying a few words about meditation, and then we're going to do about 20 minutes of meditation together. Okay, so I just want to check in with the kids. Hey, have you meditated before? You have. So how's it going? Like, are you awesome at it? I was just saying how, like, no, but nobody really thinks that they're awesome at meditation, you know. And we sometimes you look around and you think everybody else knows what they're doing, but nobody else knows what they're doing either. So don't worry about it. Okay, we all just try, but you learn by doing it, right? So it's like anything else. It's like if you want to learn to paint, right? So I've heard you pick up paints and you do it and you get good at it. I don't know. My painting's terrible. So obviously I haven't done that. But like anything, if you want to do it, you've got to practice. And if, like, you know, again, to think of a skill like that. So if your aim is to say, oh, I want to be a great painter, I want to win prizes, I want to be a professional artist, then you draw things and you think that's rubbish, and you draw things and you think that's rubbish, and you draw things and you think that's rubbish. And then your life is filled with doing things that's rubbish. I don't know. It doesn't feel like a great way to live. But actually, that says something, and then you can try again and try again and try again. So that's what meditation's about. So don't get down on yourself if you think your meditation's no good. Don't worry if you think that you're being distracted. Don't worry if you fall asleep in your meditation. Honestly, really, all of those things are really problems. The only time that they really get to be a problem is if you make a habit of it, right? So if you like sit down to meditate and you just fall asleep every time, that's not good, okay? If it happens now and then, oh, well, never mind. You probably were tired and needed a rest, so don't worry about it too much. The same thing when your mind gets distracted. Your mind will get distracted. Don't worry about it. But if you focus only on that distraction, then you're like, this is what my mind is. My mind is this distraction. But your mind is also awareness. And your mind is awareness of your meditation. We're going to be, in a minute, we're going to be doing some mindfulness of breathing. And in that mindfulness of breathing meditation, you're going to be aware of your breath at least a little bit. And when you're aware of your breath at least a little bit, then there's going to be some peace, at least a little bit. And it takes a while for you to really notice that. Okay? So don't be in a hurry. Right? Don't be in a rush to judgment. I remember how I was the first time I meditated. They told me how to meditate. You sit like this. You do this, like this, like this, like this. And so 20 minutes meditation. So I did 20 minutes meditation. Then I was like, it's kind of rubbish, wasn't it? Nothing really happened. Like, I thought I was supposed to like experience all of these great stuff and everything, but there's nothing. Oh, well, maybe try again, see how I go. So try it again. Should I swap my chair? I think I should swap my chair. What do you reckon? Or just not move. What do you think? Oh, you don't mean your chair, Lucia. Yeah, I didn't say I have to take a chair away from somebody. Okay, these other ones. This is non-squeaky. Excellent. That's better. Okay, very good. Thank you. Okay. But you see, that's the example of exactly what I was talking about. Okay? The fact that the chair was squeaky is not a problem. The fact that we could hear the squeak, which we couldn't the other week, tells us that we've got more silence already than we did then. So now we're already doing better. Yeah, I'm a bit closer to it, I guess. Okay, so we're going to be doing some mindfulness of breathing. And the trick to doing, do you want to know the trick to success in mindfulness of breathing, the secret that nobody's going to tell you? No. Oh, you don't want to know it. Thank you. You don't want to know the secret. Excellent. That's good. You do. That kind of language is horrific. Yeah, it is. Yeah, no, it is. I'm sorry. It's not a secret at all, really. But the secret to mindfulness of breathing meditation is that the less you do, then the better it's going to go. So the secret is that there's no secret. The secret is that it's okay. What you're doing is okay. Meditation's okay. The particular practice you're doing is okay. So don't worry about it too much. Just let the breath take care of you. And the more that you can get out of the way and let the breath take care of you, then the more the meditation will flow and the more you will allow the natural capacity of the mind to be aware, to grow and flourish. Okay, let's do some meditation.
So just sitting quietly. And just taking a minute to let your body settle down and your mind to become just at ease. And when your mind is reasonably still, take a minute to be aware of the breath as it comes in and the breath as it goes out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. With the mind bringing a sense of ease and softness. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. A soft feeling mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Each time your mind runs off, distracted by a sound perhaps, or propelling itself to follow some line of thought, just bring awareness to that, be mindful of it. Ah, okay. And again, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. And as you continue, you notice that your breath becomes ever so soft, ever so silky, brings you to this tranquil flow. And as the breath becomes almost too quiet to notice, then you'll feel in its place, there is a sense of pleasure. That sense of pleasure in meditation can be soft, can be weak, or it can be sometimes overpowering, joyous. You can start laughing, crying with laughter. And all of that pleasure and happiness in meditation comes from letting go. Comes from something inside you has let go. And so some suffering has disappeared. And now coming near to the end of the meditation. Letting the feeling of the breath go and bringing the mind back into just awareness of all of your senses, especially hearing, touching. And for a minute, reflecting back over the meditation. And this is where you see what the effect of the meditation is. How does your mind feel like now compared to how it was at the beginning? And sometimes you can sit to meditate and you feel like your mind is lost and distracted the whole time. And yet, when you come to the end of the meditation, you still feel more peaceful. It's because your mind isn't really distracted all the time. There's mindfulness there as well. And that mindfulness is what leads to peace. And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. Very good. So thanks for that. Oh, thanks. Navel gazing has given us an excellent question. Was the Buddha a Buddhist? And I'd like to just congratulate navel gazing on the name question synergy that's going on there. We may even get to answer that soon. Okay, excellent. Let's have a bit of a break and then we can come back and gaze at our navels some more. Right. All right. So very good.
So we've got a couple of questions there. I'm not going to answer those questions exactly right now. Then maybe they might come up in the talk, but I did have a talk in mind for this evening. If for those of you who've been around for the few weeks coming up to the Vasa, might recall that I was giving some talks on the Buddha's life from his enlightenment up to the teaching of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, and that there's a series of events and a story that's being told, which is found in Pali in the first chapter of the Khandakas of the Pali Vinaya. It's also found in various other places, but that's the main source for those events. And so we've talked a bit about some of those events here. I've also gave some talk on some of those events in the Crow's Nest on the Wednesday night. And I built the whole thing up to this mammoth climax of like teaching the first sermon, and then we didn't do it because we got noised out, so that didn't happen. So you're all on tenterhooks. What is going to happen? Oh my God. Okay, so let's do it. So if you remember the story thus far, our hero, the Buddha, got enlightened, did some meditation and stuff, walked from Bodh Gaya to Benares, met the five monks who at first didn't want to have anything to do with him because they thought that he was a backslider, that he had reverted to luxury. So they're like, we're not going to have anything to do with this guy. But they couldn't help themselves. And they received his bowl and they put out the foot washing water. And then the Buddha persuaded them to listen to his teaching, and that's more or less where we left off. So then the Buddha gave the discourse, which we know in Buddhism as the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, or the rolling forth of the wheel of the Dhamma, aka the first sermon. And this is one of the most famous discourses in all of Buddhism, perhaps the most famous, and it's found in comparative studies. There's like 16 or 20 different versions of it. And the teachings from this sutta are echoed, quoted, expounded upon, analyzed, and referred to any number of times throughout all of the Buddhist scriptures. In fact, you could even consider the entirety of the Buddhist scriptures as being a commentary on the first sermon. The Buddha said that the first discourse, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, first contains the Four Noble Truths. It's like the elephant's footprint, which is so big that it contains the footprint of all other animals. Now, as you know, my own personal bent is that I am an inquirer. I don't like to take things just for granted. Recently, I was in Sri Lanka, and I can confirm elephants do, in fact, have very big feet. Okay, so just in case you're wondering whether the Buddha was right about that, yes, it definitely is true. So elephants have very big feet, and the Four Noble Truths contain the kernel of the Buddha's teachings, which spill out and magnify to fill up all of the other teachings which the Buddha gave. One characteristic of this particular discourse is numbers. Yeah, in fact, the very first word in this discourse, dwe, two, right? There's the two extremes, there's the Four Noble Truths, there's the three of this, there's the four of that. Everything's in numbers. So the Buddha's teaching and these numbers all interlock. It's very kind of interesting and very subtle. So these teachings give a series of interlocking numbers, which you can relate to, well, many things. You can relate to day and night, or you could relate to like the Four Noble Truths, right? They can be like the 4 weeks in a month, and then the 12 then is like the 12 months in a year, and so on and so forth. So there's many different ways you can consider the interlocking meaning and relationship of all of these things. Why is this important? It's important because it shows that the Buddha presented his teaching from the beginning as a coherent whole, that there is a pattern to what he did right from the start. Think about how you present things. If you're learning about something, you come along and then somebody says, oh, you know, how do you make this cake? And you're like, well, I don't know. I guess you just get some flour. I don't know. You try this out, you do this. And you gradually work your way towards figuring out an explanation for it. And the Buddha's teaching is not like that. Right from the beginning, he gives almost like this kind of matrix or this square, which is like presenting this pattern of the teaching, which is in Buddhism, that's represented in images like the mandala. Right, so mandala gives that same kind of idea that the teaching has these kind of four sides and it has all these things. And this is really drawing from that characteristic of the Dhamma, which we find right from the first teaching. So that's something about the pattern of the teaching. So what about the content of it? Dwe me bhikkhave anta pabbajitena na sevitabba. Right, so these two extremes that should not be cultivated by somebody who has gone forth. And so this is the Buddha's opening gambit, all right? Okay, dwe me bhikkhave. So he's presenting something, right? So notice a few things about the nature of what he's doing. First thing, he's pretty confident, right? He's just saying this is what should be done. And second thing is he has an audience in mind, right? So it says pabbajitena, right? For those who've renounced. Okay, most of the people here are lay people. So if you want, you can say, hey, this doesn't mean me. I can just switch off and vague out and just not even notice the rest of it. If you want to, you can. But perhaps also it's true that those of us who are on the path aren't perhaps so neatly divided into these groups as we might like to think, because we're all holding on to something and we're all letting go of something. Yeah. So I've been in these kinds of situations. I remember one time I was invited to do a blessing for a wedding, young couples getting married. So for Buddhist monastics, we don't do like wedding ceremonies, but we will do like a blessing for the wedding. We'll give the precepts to the married couple and so on. But this married couple, they weren't very conventional. They decided that when I gave them the five precepts, that was their wedding. So according to them, that I'd married them. They're like, oh, yeah, we'll go and sign the paper afterwards, but, you know, we're married now. I'm like, okay, whatever. I don't know. Whatever. So it's fine. And but I remember at that event, you know, somebody was walking around drinking some alcohol, and then somebody says, oh, okay, you shouldn't be, you know, drinking alcohol. It's against the precepts. And then she just said, oh, no, that's for the monks. So as far as she was concerned, if you do the, she's done her bit, and now it's up to us to keep the precepts for them. Anyway, point being that that's not really how things go, and that these teachings actually are universally applicable, even though it might not work out exactly the same for everybody, right? And so clearly the Buddha wouldn't have begun this teaching in the same way if he was teaching for lay people. Right, so he would have opened it in different ways. So we can bear that in mind, but it doesn't mean that it's irrelevant. Dwe me bhikkhave anta, so the two extremes. So this, of course, is one of the most noteworthy characteristics of the Buddha's teachings, is that it avoids two extremes. So avoiding extremes does not mean balancing extremes. Okay, a bit of this and a bit of that. Right? It means not having anything to do with either of them, right? So it means the idea that when we get caught in these extremes, that it's creating, in a way, it suggests that the extremes are a false dichotomy, right? And so the solution is not a bit of this and a bit of that. Anta pabbajitena na sevitabba. And so then the Buddha goes on. First one is sensual indulgence, right? Yokame sukama sukalikanu yogo. Painful, ignoble, and harmful. Yeah. Now, so think about it in the audience that the Buddha's talking to at that time, right? Talking to the five monks, right? These guys are hardcore. Okay, they're like seriously hardcore. All right, like if you think you know what hardcore is, you don't, because they were like probably would wander naked and like never bathe for their entire life, this kind of stuff, like stand on one leg for like a year. I don't know. The suttas don't really give us the details of what they were doing, but we know what kinds of things that they would have been doing. So hardcore. And so when the Buddha's saying no sensual indulgence is bad, so then the one thing he's letting them know, oh, that actually he's not a backslider, that they were incorrect to project this on him, right? Actually, they called him a backslider. Why? Because he had something to eat, right? And at the same time, right, you can see that the first thing that the Buddha does is to find common ground, all right, to find common ground. And this is a pattern that we see throughout the suttas again and again and again and again, right, to begin by finding common ground. And it's something which I think I really rue the fact that we seem to have lost the art of meaningful debate, and especially online. There's no context, there's no empathy, there's no assumption of good faith in people, right? So it's just really hard to have any kind of conversation with anybody online. If you have a conversation with someone online, it goes for like two or three comments and everybody ends up happy, then you're like, oh, whew, oh, that's a relief. And we haven't ended up having a misunderstanding in an argument after two or three comments, because it's like, it's so that capacity to begin by agreeing. But then another problem that we have, and especially you see this in a lot of religious circles, spiritual circles, is that people don't move on from that. You start by looking for something in common, and then that's it. And then you're like, oh, we're all the same. All right? And this also is deadening to genuine conversation. I remember, like, soon after I had started practicing Dhamma, was in Chiang Mai, did some meditation retreats. I went to Wat Nanachat in northeast Thailand, and I was there as an Anagarika, looking, you know, not really at that time, you know, thinking of becoming a monk, but at least, you know, staying long term in the monastery. Anyway, so this bunch of Christians came and stayed in the monastery for a few days, and they were just traveling around and getting some experiences and so on. And then one day, you know, a few of the lay people there had this chat with these Christians, and we exchanged different points of view and so on and so forth. And at the end of it, the leader of this Christian group says, well, it seems that we're all the same because we're all looking for someone to save us. And all the Buddhists in the audience, Buddhists in the group, just looked at each other and like, well, what was the point of all that, you know? And it's like this, I mean, it's this inability or incapacity to hear or to sort of go beyond that idea, to recognize that you can have some things in common and then some things not in common. I know, crazy, right? I mean, what's the point in talking to people if you've got nothing in common? You're just going to yell at each other. But also, what's the point in talking to people if you're going to agree about everything? It's so boring. You've got to be able to disagree with each other, right? Otherwise, life is just so dull and you never learn anything. That's what ChatGPT is for. Okay, moving along. Moving along. So he gets them on side. Okay, no sensual indulgence. They're all like, great, yeah, yeah. And then he says, also not the extreme of self-mortification. Right? Self-mortification. Then they're like, what? Crazy. Right? But because you've already created common ground, you can then introduce the differences. This is the Buddha's basic rhetorical strategy. He uses this again and again and again. And it's all prefigured right in that first line of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Yeah, it's amazing. You go through, you can find there's hundreds of suttas where you can see the Buddha does exactly the same thing. So no self-mortification. So what these guys were doing, they were really hurting themselves. You know, they call this practice tapas, right? So tapas literally means fire. So the idea was that you create enough pain in your body that there's literally a fire. Like tapas isn't like a metaphor. Tapas is an actual fire that burns your body. And by burning your body, because of the extreme pain that you're subject to, it then burns off all of the karma and all of the suffering and everything, like very much like you're putting ore into a cauldron and then burning, melting it, and then burning off all of the impurities. So you're doing that with tapas, which is a literal fire. Really important to bear this in mind, because we always tend to think things are metaphors. So the Buddha used tapas as a metaphor. Yes, he used it in that way, right? To talk about like ardent effort or making a fervent effort. So he redefined tapas. But for the ascetics in that day, it was an actual fire that burnt your body from the inside. So we're getting some great questions today. So thank you so much for that. I'm going to try to get to them because they are good questions. Okay, so what are we going to do if we're not doing these two extremes? So again, notice that the Buddhist path is not to have, well, I'm going to have a bit of sensual pleasures and then a bit of self-mortification, okay? In other words, first I'm going to have some cake and then I'm going to go for a run. Right? And then when I get back from my run, so I'm going to do my cake to give me energy for the run, and then when I get back from the run, I've done so good. There is another slice of cake there, you know. So we tend to bounce between extremes, right? And that tends to be how your mind works. And so the Buddha is saying, don't even think about it in that way, because like either giving pleasure to your body or giving pain to your body is not actually helping. That's not the point of spiritual path. So that is the middle way. The middle way isn't a balance. The middle way is avoiding, think about it as rejecting that dichotomy, avoiding stepping out of the horns of the dilemma, creating a new paradigm. And so what's that new paradigm? I am eva ario atangiko mago, this very noble eightfold path, which is, hang on, remind me. Right view, right intention, okay? Right speech. Sorry? Action. Right livelihood, okay? Right effort. Right mindfulness. And right samadhi, okay? Very good. Okay, excellent. Thank you. Thank you for reminding me. So this is the path that the Buddha said is the middle way, right, which leads to peace and leads to nibbana, leads to awakening, leads to higher knowledge. So let me break down this Noble Eightfold Path briefly. I've talked about this many times in these sessions, so I'm just going to run over it just for now. Okay, so right view essentially means understanding things in terms of the Four Noble Truths, which is met with later on in the sermon itself. Four Noble Truths: suffering, origin of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the path to the ending of suffering. In other words, seeing things by right view means understanding that suffering is created from inside ourselves, and we are responsible to be able to let go of that suffering, and there is a means to do that, which is what we call the path. Right? That's the essence of the Four Noble Truths. Right view, right intention, right? So right intention, acting from or thinking, using your mind in a way that has compassion, that has love, that has letting go and renunciation, rather than acting from anger, from ill will, from holding on. So right view gives you the theory, right? Whereas think about right intention as being something like the emotion and the quality of mind that brings meaning to that theory. Like there's a certain aridness if you just take things as being from a theoretical basis. You see, if people are all like Four Noble Truths, everything's suffering, 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 but then there's no metta in the heart, then there's something missing, you know? If there's no compassion in the heart, there's something missing in that path. And so these two really complement each other. The Four Noble Truths by itself, if you, it can be almost like if you don't have any metta, and you take up the Four Noble Truths, you can start blaming everybody for their suffering. Oh, why are you suffering? Oh, because you're craving, you're attached, you know? So we don't help each other. We don't look out for each other. So these things go together, right? Four Noble Truths, right intention, right speech, yeah? Speech that is truthful, that is kind, that is reconciling, speech that is meaningful. In the world that we live in today, we are swamped by a tsunami of meaningless, lying, hateful speech to a degree that is unprecedented in the world. It's hard to imagine that with all of the technology, all of the learning and the understanding that we've got, we've put ourselves in a situation where right speech has become so rare. Really. And, you know, you can see that, like, not to get too political, but you can see that even just looking back a couple of generations, and you see, like, how people talked, like leaders or politicians, how they talked compared to how they talk today, all the name-calling and mudslinging, all the divisiveness and everything. It's this real degeneration in the public sphere of how people talk to each other. We're not going to fix that. But we can avoid making it worse, and we can help in our to not normalize it. So in our circles, in our family, in our friendships, in our workplaces where we are studying, then we can try to use our voices in a way that is kind and uplifting and sincere and meaningful, right? And to bring something positive and constructive to that situation rather than excusing ourselves for being dragged down to the lowest common denominator. Okay, fine. Moving along, right speech, right action, not to kill, not to steal, not to commit sexual misconduct. So, again, I might just move on a little bit because I don't want to get too much into all of these things. And then next one, right livelihood, also part of the Eightfold Path, often forgotten. Your job is the your job is a factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, so do not go to work, do your job all day, and then come back and then think, oh, I haven't had any time to practice. That is wrong view, actually. The time to practice is at your work where you are practicing right livelihood. Hopefully, if you're doing wrong livelihood, try to change it and do right livelihood, right? And moving along, right livelihood, right effort. Okay, so this means applying yourself, especially to let go of things that are unwholesome and develop things that are wholesome. And right mindfulness, right, especially means the development of meditations, what we were doing a little bit earlier, being mindful of our breathing. And finally, right samadhi. So right samadhi is the culmination of the Noble Eightfold Path. And when all of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path have been fully developed to perfection, they culminate in right samadhi, which is a very profound state of mind where the mind is unified and integrated and blissful and peaceful. And that is the Noble Eightfold Path. And from there, from emerging from the Noble Eightfold Path, one sees the truth, sees the Four Noble Truths. So this is the middle way that was taught by the Buddha. And the Buddha then goes on, after teaching the middle way, to then teach the Four Noble Truths themselves, suffering. The origin of suffering, namely craving and attachment to pleasures and to getting reborn and to getting not reborn, and then letting go, which is the third noble truth, and then the path, which is the fourth noble truth. So these teachings were repeated and expanded on constantly throughout the Buddha's life, and so I'm not going to go into too much detail into all of them right now. But one of the distinctive teachings that the Buddha gives in this sutta is also the teaching on the three modes in which all of the Four Noble Truths are experienced. Okay, and so I just want to discuss a little bit about this because this is distinctive of this particular teaching. So the first thing he said was that he realized this is suffering, this is the origin of suffering, this is the ending of suffering, this is the path leading to the ending of suffering, right? So this is the first of the three rounds, okay? There are three cycles or three rounds, and this is the first one. And so this is simply realizing the fact of these Four Noble Truths. Okay, so you just realize that this is the case. You realize that there is suffering. You realize that craving is the cause of suffering. You realize that the ending of that craving is the ending of that suffering. And you realize that the Noble Eightfold Path is the path to realizing the ending of that suffering. Okay, now in the Dhammacakka Sutta itself, it doesn't say anything more specifically about that, but generally speaking, in the suttas, when it talks about realizing the Four Noble Truths like that, it's talking about what we call stream entry. So the stream enterer or the sovan or the sotapanna is the one who realizes the Four Noble Truths. It's very consistent. It's found many, many times in the suttas. So I'm fairly confident that that's what the Buddha is talking about at that point. That's the point where he realized the Four Noble Truths for the first time, thus becoming what later on would be called the stream enterer. Now, one of the things that the stream enterer is always said that they have to do is to then further develop that path. And that's what the second of the three rounds is. So the second of the three rounds is framed as a future passive participle for all of the Pali geeks who are here. What is it? The first one is Parinyaya. First noble truth is to be fully known. And then the second noble truth of craving, pahataba, to be abandoned. Third noble truth of the ending of suffering, the ending of suffering is sachikataba, to be realized, to be witnessed. Literally means should be seen with your own eyes. Yeah, sachikataba. And then the last one, bhavetaba, the path is to be developed. So path is to be made more of. So then once you see those truths, then the same thing, but just more of it, right? And so that's the duty or the kitcha that's associated with that second cycle in the Four Noble Truths. And then the third one is parinyata has been fully known. The first suffering has been fully known. The origin of suffering has been abandoned. The ending of suffering has been witnessed, and the path has been developed. And so that's the stage of full enlightenment or arahantship, which culminates the Buddha's path. So in my view, these three rounds correspond with those stages of development of the path. One of the things which is interesting about that is that the first noble truth, right, suffering, parinyaya, to be fully known. That's bad news, isn't it? Aren't we supposed to be like not having it? And then said the Buddha says you should fully know it. I'd like to not fully know it, actually, as much as possible, and just like know as little of it as possible. But the Buddha's like, no. You should know everything about suffering, right? So this speaks to what I was talking about earlier with the meditation, like when you're meditating and stuff's going bad and you're experiencing pain and your mind's distracted and feeling anxious or all of those things, good on you. Yeah, you're parinyaya, you're fully knowing suffering. That's what it is. Yeah. And the funny thing about suffering is that if you, like most of the time, it's kind of a bit of a paper tiger. I'm not saying always, but most of the kinds of suffering that you have, when you turn around, you face it, it's okay. It's actually just anxiety. It's actually just sadness. It's just like an emotion. It's all right. It's just like pain. It's like a feeling. And so, of course, suffering is hard to bear. That's by definition, it's hard to bear. But when you face it, then you show your confidence. If you're always running away from suffering, it will keep chasing you down. You have to turn around and face it and to fully know it. Otherwise, you're never going to be free. So parinyaya, to fully know that suffering. Yeah.
And okay, so this is the three rounds. And then the Buddha goes on to say that until he had fully understood and fully practiced the Dhamma according to these three rounds, then he did not claim to be awakened. So this calls back to the beginning of the sutta, because as the sutta was being set up, and then he came and he spoke to the five monks, and then they noticed that there was something different about him. Right? His appearance, the way he spoke, his demeanor was changed. And he pointed that out, and he said, "Have you ever seen me like this before?" They said, "No." And so now he's pointing out, this is what's happened. This is what has changed. He's actually seen these Four Noble Truths in these ways. Now, I don't know about you, but I find it's kind of, how do I put this? It seems to me that there's a kind of a tension in the Buddhist tradition and the way the Buddhism is presented normally, because normally it will tell you that the Buddha became a Buddha by developing these perfections over countless thousands of lifetimes. And that's how he became a Buddha. And when you present it that way, then it becomes kind of like, we can't really do it. we just do it like a little bit, can't really do that. So, I don't know, we can maybe do a little bit or something like that. But those ideas about all of the development of the perfections, whether the six perfections of the Mahayana or the 10 perfections of the Theravada, the determination, like making a vow in past life, an adhisthana in past life, and meeting past Buddhas, renewing his vows, none of that we find in the early suttas, like not at all. There's not even a hint of it. All of that was developed maybe 200 to 400 years after the Buddha. In the suttas themselves, in fact, the Buddha quite clearly says that he did not become enlightened because of something that he did in his past life. He became enlightened because what he says in the Dhammacakka Sutta, he practiced the Noble Eightfold Path to realize the Four Noble Truths. And so when you see that, to my mind, that's very hopeful, because it really brings it down to earth. And we can say that those Four Noble Truths are things that all of us can and should realize, and things that we all have realized, at least to some degree. And we've all seen suffering. We've all seen how we can cause suffering because of our own stupidity. And we've all seen how it's possible to let go of that and be free of that suffering. And we all have some idea that there is a path that we can practice that's going to help us leap beyond that. That's the Four Noble Truths. And if we can see that in our own lives, then we can develop it. We can make more of it. So hopefully that's something that the Buddha wanted to encourage us to do, and hopefully that we can all achieve. So after the Buddha explained all of this, then at the end of it you had Anya Kondanya, one of the group of five monks. His name was Kondanya. Then he realized the Four Noble Truths for himself. And the Vidamalang Dhammachakung Udapadi, Yankinchi Samudaya Dhammang Sabantang Nirodha Dhammanti. Everything that has a beginning must also have an end. And so he saw that for himself. So this is the promise of the Buddha's teachings. The promise of the Buddha's teachings is that this is not just a historical record. It's not just an account of something that happened to somebody else some other time. It's an account of the reality that is happening right here and right now. And just as the Buddha realized it, so too can you realize it. And so too can every single person right here can realize this. The path leads to Nibbana, it leads to freedom from suffering. That's the Buddha's teachings. It's not you, it's not about you. And it's not about whether you can do it or you can't do it. That's all irrelevant. It doesn't actually matter. As long as you do it, the path will lead to the destination. Okay? If you're walking down the road and you're thinking, I can't make it to the end of the road, I mean, it's not going to help. It's not helpful, right? You're walking down the road thinking, oh, I'm never going to make it. Oh, I'm never going to make it. Okay, it's not a fun walk, right?
But as long as you actually do keep walking, you will make it, right? It's the same thing in your practice. You can tell yourself as much as you like, oh, I can't meditate, I can't do these things. But as long as you keep practicing, then you will get there. So you might as well just not bother with all that negative thinking anyway, right? That's just extra burden that you're going to have to carry. So then Kandanya realized the Dhamma, and then he became known as Anya Kandanya, Kandanya who's understood. Anyasi Wataboho Kandanyo, Anyasi Wataboho Kandanyo. Now, the text in the Pali edition and various other editions then says that this realization was then taken up and the gods cried it up to the highest heaven, to the Brahma heaven, until all of the gods were singing about the victory that had been achieved in the deer park at Isipatana. If you are fortunate enough to visit India and to go to Benares, or Varanasi, they call it these days, then please do visit the deer park and you can join in with the Sangha reciting the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta in the temple there. They recite that every night. So if you go along, that's a really inspiring thing to do. And I believe, I think they're actually streaming that online as well. So you can join online if you want to chant wherever you are in the world now. So, so this is the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the rolling forth of the wheel of the Dhamma that cannot be turned back by anyone in the world. So this is a very kind of brief introduction to that discourse, and hopefully that will inspire you to look further and to practice further into the Buddhist teachings. Okay. All right, very good. A couple questions online. Briefly, if you take these before we go on, I'll ask the question in the room. Number one, was the Buddha a Buddhist? That's kind of those questions. Definition? Yes. Is it okay if somebody opens the door for us? Leo. Oh, that was you guys, was it? You're Leo. Excellent. Well, you made it. Awesome. Were you here or were you over at Harris Park? No, you were here. Okay, your first time here. Yeah. So you can come in through the front, but also you can come around the back and come through here if you want as well. I thought you were another Leo. I know another Leo. I thought he was over at Harris Park anyway. Fine. Moving along. Okay, Marian asks about, can I explain what are Pacheka Buddhas? How can they attain full enlightenment without a teacher? Okay, so as we talked about in that sutta, then the attainment of full enlightenment really just means that you practice the Eightfold Path and you realize the Four Noble Truths. And there's nothing personal about that. So the Buddhist tradition has always understood that there are many people who will do that from time to time, simply through their own wisdom and their own understanding. And Gautama Buddha, our Buddha, did that and then taught and established a community. But then there are others who maybe have the same realization, but then they kind of keep to themselves and just do some meditation. They might share some teachings now and then or something like that, but they're not really getting out there and building a community and establishing things in that way. So this is what we call a Pacheka Buddha. So they practice, they realize the same enlightenment, but they mostly just live in some mountain or some cave or something like that. And the traditional viewpoint is that you can't have a Pacheka Buddha as long as Buddhism is still around, right? So when you have a Sammasambuddha, like a fully awakened Buddha, Pacheka Buddhas are still proper Buddhas. Fully awakened Buddha, then if you're interested in practice, then you'd find a connection with those teachings through the teachings of our Buddha. That's the traditional take on that. So it really, the idea of a Pacheka Buddha is really a recognition that there have been great sages of the past who've had various kinds of realizations and understanding. Okay, Naval Gazing asks, is it possible to pay a reasonable fee, not exorbitant, to buy the title Venerable from a reputable Buddhist group? No, it is not. Tim says, Naval, quite possible. The fee would be to shave off your head and keep 227 precepts diligently. Is there an estimate? So no, you cannot buy. Neelakshi says, if you pay with your estate, I'll call you venerable. Okay. Everyone has their price, I guess. Everyone has a price. Okay, Raju says, greetings from India. Letty says, sadhu. Thanks, Pante. No worries, Letty. Heidi says this, great talk. I learned a lot, which surprised me because I've heard so many of your talks. I guess, like, I'm going to take that as a compliment. No, seriously. Please don't even think twice about it, Heidi. Like, has my practice advanced this year? It's a bit personal, isn't it? What about your practice? How's your practice going, Heidi? No, I'm glad that you learned something from this talk. And look, this is something that I'm conscious of. When I've been teaching Dhamma for a while now, and you know, you always try to put things in different ways, try to learn things new ways, try to express them. Because it actually, to my mind, speaks to one of the key points about this particular sutta. The Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths. Okay, we've explained that. The Eightfold Path, okay, we've explained that. It's not too complicated. Most of us here, if we've been around in Buddhism for a while, have heard that before. Also, and I know I'm generalizing, please correct me if I'm wrong, but most of us, unlike Kundanya, didn't get enlightened when we heard about it the first time. Or the second time, or the third time, right? Now, obviously, there are some conditions that are different, okay? Number one, we don't have a Buddha teaching us, okay? Number two, Kundanya had obviously been doing a lot of practice. Maybe his practice had been partially misguided. I think it's also worth bearing in mind, though, that because they were practicing something like Jainism, right? Jainism is actually a very beautiful religion. The foundations of Jainism is non-harming. And they have incredible sense of love and compassion for all sentient beings. So when the Buddha was criticizing this practice of self-mortification, don't take that as meaning that he was saying that like everything about what they were doing and what their practice was wrong. You know, clearly, actually, many things in Buddhism are very, very similar to what you find in Jainism. In fact, like just purely like on the textual level, many words and phrases which you find in Buddhism that you find in Jainism as well. For example, in the Metta Sutta, it says you should have metta for all beings, tasava, tavarava, right? Any being small or great. That same line you find in the Jaina suttas as well, right? In the same meaning. So there's actually many things in common. So Kundanya already had done many practices and so on and so forth, and he just needed that little extra bit to get him over the edge. But we have heard these teachings many times, and then often they become stale, right? You don't have that freshness, right? You imagine that sense of keenness with which they would have been listening to it, right? And then we hear it once, twice, three times. Oh, yeah, Four Noble Truths, yeah, heard that, yeah, whatever. And you don't want to do that, but it happens. You can't help it. So this is why I think it's important as a Dhamma teacher. It's something that I try to do, is to always try to bring a new perspective to things. And I think in terms of Dhamma practice as well, that's also really crucial for practitioners, is to try to challenge yourself, to try to think of like what new things could I do, what new ways could I approach things that's going to try to bring that freshness. It's not about the quantity of Dhamma that we hear, but it's about the quality of awareness that we bring to it. All right. Very good. So any questions from the room? Adrian.
I was always curious about the five bhikkhus one day. Would you say that they're at least like a
generation older than the Buddha. Why would you say that?
Just because, like, I was thinking about, you know, in the introduction to the Anapanasati Sutta.
Right.
You know, it sort of goes through all the prominent.
Right.
Bhikkhus, the elders, but it doesn't mention Asaji, or it doesn't mention Kundanya.
Right.
Like, I don't know the other three.
Right, Vapa?
Right. But yeah.
What are they? Kundanya, Asaji, Vapa. Can you remember them all? Padia? Asaji, we already had Asaji. Mahanama, was he one of them? Mahanama, okay. Okay. But yeah, certainly we don't hear about them much after this thing. They Asaji comes in two or three suttas. Gandanya comes in one or two. So yeah, look, honestly, I think that mostly they were just, they were pretty quiet. You know, I mean, they were already kind of long term. It could well have been the case that they were older than the Buddha, for sure. Yeah, suttas don't give us an age. Could be the case. But they also, I think they just like being by themselves. Yeah. Yeah, go on.
I just occurred to me just then that yeah, like, so would you say that it's very rare that, you know, you can go from like unenlightened to, from being unenlightened to straight to Arahant? Like, so it seems like, because yeah, it just occurred to me, like when you were doing the talk, that, you know, like in several suttas they sort of mentioned that, oh yeah, you know, like you go from, You go to stream entry,
right,
and then you could potentially go from stream entry to Arahant,
right?
Skip the two. Is that like, so you always probably go
do you think
first and then?
So you have to go step by step through the four different stages of enlightenment. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, like, yeah. Instead of just going from being like a Patujana
to an Arahant.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the suttas are a bit ambiguous on that point. I mean, it just talks about someone just attaining arahantship or something, but it also, like, you know, specifies these four stages. I mean, I guess you know, the obvious resolution would be you can go through the four stages quickly. It certainly doesn't have to be all at separate times or whatever. Like, this particular sutta doesn't really tell us how long it took the Buddha, right? So the first realization and then the development and then the full realization, right? But, I mean, that could have all been in a few seconds.
Right.
I don't know. It sort of doesn't tell us, right?
Yeah.
It could have been over the course of the night, or it could have been, you know. I mean, it probably was all at least in that one night, we could probably say, right? Yeah.
That one then became an Arahant.
He became an Arahant quickly, yeah. Well, after the second sermon, they all became Arahants. Yeah. Sorry?
It can happen
Yeah, it can happen quickly, yeah. Sorry, another question, yeah. Good enough. Yalushi?
I was wondering about the statement that you said earlier on about suffering. You know, I can't quite remember the exact words, but it sounded to me a bit like saying that it's all within yourself, and that, you know, sort of, and that's something I was just struggling with a bit, and just to like, you know, there is external causes, right?
Sure, yeah.
And if you, I don't know, if you're born in like a really terrible circumstance, and
right,
you're constantly, like, how would you be able to, practicing things like that. But yeah, I'm just wondering what you meant by that statement, because I can understand that, you know, on some level, for some things you can transcend and get that distance, but at the same time, I think they're just, it's definitely external cause of the suffering.
Okay, so Nilushi's asking about the fact that there are obviously external causes of suffering as well as internal causes, right? So, I mean, yes, obviously that's true, but on the one hand, the purpose of a spiritual path isn't necessarily to solve those external forms of suffering, as one thing. But it's also that if basically at an ultimate level, like if you get enlightened, you're not going to get reborn, and then you're not going to have those external forms of suffering as well. So that internal cause of suffering is at a more profound level, right? But it doesn't mean that the kinds of suffering that we experience in life are meaningless or are, you know, trivial or can be cast aside. As you mentioned, like if you're suffering from poverty, or if you're under political suppression, or if you're disabled, then those things can make it very hard to practice and make it very hard to live or to do any of those things. So yeah, definitely it's not to marginalize other forms of suffering. Yes.
I find this very interesting with the 5 months.
Okay.
5 months as well, that it's not more seniority. Maybe this was the intention of the Buddha, not to establish a hierarchy. But, the company was founded today and was a founder.
Right.
There was an employee, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Right.
Pretty important.
Okay. Okay. So if we establish a company and you had the first 5 employees, they'd all probably get shares in the company, and so they'd be all like 100 billionaires by now, depending on the company. So these guys tend to more or less just disappeared. So yeah, like we kind of commented before, they didn't quite disappear. And there is that respect for seniority when they do show up. Like when Kondanya appears, then, you know, it's a bit of a big deal. People are like, hey, Kondanya's here, right? We haven't seen him for a while. So I'm pretty sure, like, they were, like, not all of the bhikkhus or bhikkhunis were, like, really involved in stuff, okay? They were out there in some mountain or some forest or maybe even just in some kuti, quietly living their life. So in Buddhism, seniority and hierarchy doesn't really work the way that, or at least it's not supposed to work in that way, okay? So in terms of the way that the Buddha organized the Sangha, okay, seniority makes no difference. You don't get any power by being senior, and you don't get anything really. You get to take your food first at the mealtime, okay? Fair enough, okay? That's a pretty good benefit, but still... Still, all in all, like, there's not too much, right? So there's like a respect and a deference, which is to those who are senior, but they're not like in control of anything. So in terms of like doing teaching, the monks who would be doing teaching would be the ones who are good at doing teaching. And that doesn't mean everyone, especially even if you're enlightened. Not all people who are enlightened are good at talking, right? So they're still setting an example. They're still considered just as valuable members of the Sangha, but they're playing different roles. And like you even see this is discussed in some places where, for example, Anuruddha and Ananda, who both were similar in terms of seniority in the Sangha, and they were cousins of each other. But there's like a dispute came up and then Ananda says to, sorry, the Buddha says to Ananda, you know, when, you know, I think some of Anuruddha's students or something had caused some kerfuffle. And the Buddha said, well, when have you seen Anuruddha actually involve himself in the affairs of the Sangha, right? He was actually just out there meditating or something like that. And so the different people are playing these different kinds of roles. It's not, in theory, it's not based on seniority. However, worth saying that in practice, in modern Buddhism, that's become the case that everything's based on seniority, but that certainly wasn't the Buddha's intent. Yeah. Okay, so Venerable Vimala has to leave early. Venerable, I didn't even see you there. Okay, so we should probably wrap up about there. Thanks, everybody, for coming along. Thanks to all the Venerables for attending, none of whom deserve the title of Venerable from the money that they paid for it, but have only deserved the title of Venerable by living a Venerable lifestyle. Anyway, and thanks everybody for coming and for being a part of our little community here. And I wish you all happiness and freedom. And I look forward to seeing you next week. Before everyone leaves, Venerable Metta Vihari has joined us today. He's in Sydney for a little while and he's doing a talk with the Metta Center on Monday night at
7 o'clock
at Bankstown. So check the Metta Center website for Venerable Metta Vihari's talk in Bankstown, Monday, 7 a.m. I'm doing a talk on Wednesday also. With much nicer chairs. That's correct. Much nicer chairs. That's true. A bit of venue rivalry here. Okay. Thanks, everybody, and look forward to seeing you again soon.